would be fine, a man to be in Carolina in the morning. In Carolina.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading excerpts from Bill Prouty's Chapel Hill by William Prouty, whose family moved to Chapel Hill in 1919. Bill Prouty was a newspaper columnist, and the contents of these articles first appeared in the Chapel Hill Weekly and the Chapel Hill newspaper. The day Ratliff set his Waco down. It's getting so nowadays that folks don't even look up when airplanes pass over. That is, not with the ordinary purring type. Though the jet jobs, those flame-throwing stovepipes with fins that splinter the heavens a wink ahead of their unearthly screeches, still draw their share of attention. It's the light, propeller-driven passenger plane that I'm talking about. Seldom do they cause even as much as an eyebrow to lift when they soar overhead. How different is this present-day apathy from the state of complete ecstasy into which the kids of my time were thrown by just hearing an airplane motor, even though we didn't get a glimpse of the plane itself. The village in those days, the early 20s, didn't have a landing field, as we called them, and seldom if ever would a plane light here, but would take off for greener pastures after nuzzling around for a while, looking in vain for a level spot in that town's hilly terrain. One summer day, a plane did make it. Though I'm not sure whether it was the first one to do so, it's the first one I recall. A bunch of us Westwood boys were playing ball on the tennis court between our house and our neighbors, the H.W. Odoms. Out of the southwest, there came the unmistakable purr of an airplane engine, interwoven with the whirring sound of a propeller against air. As the buzz became a drone and then turned into a roar, baseball was forgotten, and bats, balls, and gloves dropped to the ground as all eyes searched through the heavy oak and pine foliage for a glimpse of the plane. Finally, it burst into an opening directly overhead. Don't they always come directly overhead? And kept going on its northeasterly route. We listened intently, expecting the engine to fade slowly out. But it didn't. In a very few minutes, it stopped altogether. We all looked at each other with broad grins on our faces. And then yells broke out among us, because that plane had lit someplace near, either on purpose or through necessity. In either case, we'd get to see a plane up close. Vernon Ratliff was a big, good-natured man who loved to fly. And he was the one whose plane had broken up our ball game the day before. Now we were down in the pasture bottom land, later owned by Mr. Luke Connor, but today filling up with apartment houses and businesses along Willow Drive. Vernon was barnstorming the village and campus sports as fast as he could jolt them loose from a $5 bill and get them into his Waco biplane, powered with a World War I surplus OX motor. How we young'uns longed for a ride in that beautiful silver plane. We'd have given anything we owned to be one of those lucky older fellows with enough money for a ride. But we knew that we had very little chance to get a ride, because very few parents in the village in those days had $5 to throw away on such frivolities as an airplane ride. But I did get that ride. I and Jean, man, Kate, were in the first flight the next morning as Vernon's Waco climbed out of the pasture and circled the town with two happy boys as passengers. I forget the details now, but Jean, I believe it was, talked Vernon into the idea that we should stay underneath his plane that night and guard it. Against whom or what, I'm not really sure, from harm until the next day. There would, of course, be no charge for our services, but in case he wanted to take us up the next morning, we might condescend to go along with him. Vernon agreed, and then we asked our parents if we could do it. I'll never know why, but they allowed us to stay out under that plane that night, even helping us pack the necessary camping essentials. And the next morning, bright and early, Jean and I were helping Vernon gas the Waco and were ready for takeoff. If I live to be 100, I'll never forget that ride. As we taxied to the end of the field, I forgot my weariness and that we'd been awake most of the night, fighting mosquitoes and listening to the terrifying call of the hoot owl. Suddenly, I was Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, getting ready to take off to knock down the dreaded Baron von Richthofen, not little Billy Prouty, holding onto the cockpit combing, scared to death. As we gathered speed down the bumpy runway, I began to relax a little. And when we were first airborne, at that very moment when we lifted from the ground, all things earthbound faded into insignificance, and I was in the council of the gods, never fully to return. The most vivid memory that remains in connection with Ratliff's plane, however, had to do with a terrific electrical storm. A few nights after my flight, when my brother Chip was staying under the plane, one of the worst electrical storms ever to hit the village crashed out of the sky, accompanied by torrents of rain. Mother wanted to get into the car and go get the boys, but we talked her out of it, assuring her that they would go to a nearby house and would be safe. At daybreak, we heard a car in the driveway and the padding of bare feet on a soppy front walk. It was Chip, wet as a wash rag, but supremely happy and delighted at our concern. How had they fared in the storm? Had they been in danger? Not at all, Chip told us. Mr. Kate had gone to the field and had fished them out from underneath the plane, still asleep, with water up over their blankets and the lightning crackling like pistol shots. No prodigal son was ever more graciously received. The next day, Chip got his ride. But after the events of the night before, I can't believe his first flight thrilled him quite as much as mine had thrilled me. Beeps, bops, squeals, and squawks. What were the first words you ever heard over a radio? The first intelligible message sifted by your auricular senses through a maze of electronic beeps, bops, squeals, and squawks. If you do remember the early days of radio, you're hovering around the 3-score mark. More than likely, you heard it through earphones, hands pressing them tightly against hot, straining ears, eyes shifting blankly from one buddy's tense, inquisitive face to another's, as did I. Those were the infant and dramatic days of commercial radio transmission and receiving. It was in the very early 20s, and several of us kids who learned that radio signals were being received at the university infirmary, now Abernathy Hall, were sitting around a table upon which rested a small pile of strange-looking electronic devices, screwed down to a large biscuit board and connected together with wires. On the front of the homemade instrument was an upright plastic panel board connected to which there were several knobs. In the center of this mysterious equipment stood one vacuum tube, its filament warmly aglow. Intently tuning the little set was Phil Rice, son of the infirmary's registered nurse. When Phil had tuned the clearly audible, to all of us, squawk to his liking, he passed the earphones along to one of us and instructed that lucky one to hand them to the next lad after he'd listened for a while. I was at the opposite end of the line, and I thought I'd keel over from the excitement before I got the phones. Finally, the cans were reluctantly passed to me, and as I whipped them over my big ears, I heard a voice saying, "This is Pioneer Radio Station, KDKA, coming to you from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania." Since that time, I must have heard several million words over the radio. But those 12 words I heard through that little homemade one-tube set at the UNC infirmary half a century ago are the only ones I could quote you today. But that simple sentence and the music and other words that followed really shook us young'uns up. Words transmitted hundreds of miles over the air with no wires involved. And those of us in that little group who are still alive remember it to this day. So it's easy to imagine the ecstasy of the Prouty youngsters when, soon after this, Dad drove the whole family over to Montgomery Ward's in Durham and came back with a 6-tube battery-operated table radio set. This was really living. Ours was not the first store-bought radio receiving set in town, by a long shot. There were several in operation here then, the first one I remember being owned by the late Bruce Stroud, the Ford dealer. The late Charlie Martindale, the building contractor, was another of the early owners, as I recall it. But that Ward's set we got was early enough to be hard to tune. It took the best combination of positions on several knobs to get the clear signal. Yet, like all nuts that are hard to crack, the meat seemed all the sweeter for the trouble. Our set was earphones equipped, and you can imagine that occasional misunderstandings would arise as to which youngster would get the phones and for how long. It's understandable that Dad found it necessary to become a little stern about the whole business. You had to have an antenna for sets of that day, and there were three types of battery necessary, A, B, and C. The B and C batteries were dry cells, while the A unit was a wet cell battery, similar to ones used in automobile ignition systems. All this paraphernalia, plus the many knobs on the front of the set, produced a sight duplicated today only in TV science fiction shows. But what we didn't know about electronics, and that was plenty, didn't even bother us. Later, we got a squeaky, sputtering, goosenecked loudspeaker that reminded Mother of a wilting black morning glory. And though the loudspeaker cut out the scramble for the earphones, I can't say that it improved the quality of the reception, or, for that matter, further endeared us to our neighbors. But it was lots of fun. I remember especially music by Paul Whiteman and other early bands, and the delightfully wacky antics of the Two Black Crows in those early days. This, then, was the beginning of a new era. The family as a social unit has never been quite the same since. Young'uns began listening to the radio instead of their parents, and the art of homey conversation went up in electronics. But I wouldn't have missed it for anything in the world. It was an experience only one generation of youngsters will ever know. And now there are three radios around my place, which remain mostly silent, while the TV stays lit up like a pinball machine, and twice as noisy. But it's different with TV. When you're televiewing, you can't do anything else but eat. And that's bad, too, and yet another story. And therein we have begun another era, the age of sit, watch, wait, and eat, eat, eat. And now I can't even remember the last television show I saw, which was last night. But there are millions of youngsters around the country and all over the world who can. Television is to them what radio was to us, fresh and exciting entertainment, a mystery beyond comprehension or concern. Lots of old found in new. As I stood in the shade of the sidewalk elm tree in front of Laycock's shoe shop one hot late afternoon last week, I was struck again by the changes which had been wrought within my viewing range by the over 55 years of time which had intervened between then and the first time I'd laid my young eyes on downtown Chapel Hill in the summer of 1919. And the biggest difference I noticed was in the people, not the things, though the things had also changed a lot. There were lots of people, students, townspeople, business people, walking busily along both sidewalks and filling the Franklin Street stores, in the summertime yet, and with automobiles almost bumper to bumper and buses roaring slowly past. And, of course, back in 1919, there had been only a very occasional car bumping along on the hole-pocked gravel Franklin Street, powdery dust in dry weather, and a quagmire when it rained. And there were horse-drawn vehicles, too, with now and then a farm wagon or a dray bumping by. But as for people in downtown Chapel Hill in the summer back in those days, there were very few, mostly summer school students and rest-of-towns people who would move slowly in and out of mostly deserted stores. But as I stood there looking up and down the streets, I spotted enough familiar objects to bring back some vivid memories of that long-ago scene. Right across the street from where I was stands the big magnolia tree in the yard of the University Methodist Church, underneath whose shade the three tow-headed Prouty youngsters played games that summer of 1919, often at dusk tossing up small rocks into the darkening branches to pester the great numbers of raucously chirping sparrows that roosted there, caring not whom their fuss disturbed, or whose heads their droppings splattered. And it was in the shade of this same tree that Dad uncrated and reassembled the big Excelsior motorcycle which he rode around town and nearby places until he could afford a car. And in my mind's eye I could see the big old Seton Barbie home, which stood where the church's sanctuary now towers, and was our family's home until we moved to the university-built cottages in Park Place in the early 20s. And then I looked across the old Frat Row Alley to the building now occupied by the First Citizens Bank and Trust Company, which was at that time Stroud's Ford Garage, in which my brothers and I badgered the friendly mechanics, who nicknamed us Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, for steel ball taws, and where we learn some fancy words. And a little further up the street, in the building now occupied by the yogurt barn, the blackboard input, and the lotus kitchen, there was, in the same building, the rowdy and raucous old silent moving picture house, the Pickwick Theater, in which the students hurled peanuts and acorns at each other and slid drink bottles down the greasy floors, after sometimes giving warnings which were often too late. And then, eyes skipping over many other familiar places, they turned to the two now empty buildings on the north side of Franklin Street at Columbia, which were then grocery and dry goods stores owned by Sheriff R.P. Andrews. And next to these was Lee's Market, with its ice house in the back, which filled many of the ice boxes around the town. And across the street, where Big Wally's now is housed, and also the gas company, and Zoom Zoom, and many others, is the building which held the Stroud Garage for many years after it moved from its building on Frat Row. And further on down the street, my eyes came to rest on the building which now houses the Intimate Bookshop, which was for many years Berman's department store, from whose cavernous aisles we youngsters, usually aimed by Mom, selected many an item of wearing apparel under the benign guidance of Sam or Mrs. Berman. And, as my eyes turned on down the street, they came to rest on the present NCNB building, which housed in that long-ago day Eubank's Drug Store and the Bank of Chapel Hill and Patterson Brothers Drug Company, landmarks in the business progress of the village. And as my eyes focused on the other sections of the block, more familiar sights brought back more vivid memories, and especially, perhaps, when they lit on the building occupied now by the First Union National Bank. For it was here that my brother Fred managed, and I clerked, in a stationery store in the height of the Depression, when jobs were awfully hard to get. Nor were all the inspired memories kind to my mind, for as I looked up the street to where Roses is located, I remembered seeing back in the winter of 1919 coffins piled on the sidewalk in front of the E. A. Brown Hardware Store, waiting for those many who were dying in the flu and pneumonia epidemics, which still held on from 1918. And then I looked back at Ledbetter Pickard Building, which was the scene in 1920 of a great fire which destroyed the produce business of Kern Pendergraft, and had the Prouty youngsters desperately dousing the roof of their home across the street to keep the sparks from setting it afire. And then I came back to the present with a bang, my sight focusing on my motorcycle parked along with three others in the space provided us two-wheelers by the city. And from the rear of the bike, my eyes ran along its length and straight across the street right into the middle of the old magnolia tree, which was in the front yard of our home, where the Methodist Church now stands, way back in the summer of 1919 in the quaint little village of Chapel Hill. All of which, I suspect, proves nothing at all, unless that the gap between the memories from a former generation's time and the all-absorbing awareness of the present one is sometimes bridged on the strangest of vehicles. Dinner bells ring no more. The other afternoon, I was nursing my late 1953 model Green Hornet along Rosemary Street, back of the post office, when I was confronted with one of the most incongruous and, at the same time, moving sights that I've lately encountered. What was moving about what I saw was a skeleton of a house, its bared frames sticking up into the gray winter sky like last year's crops stripped and blackened corn stalks standing in a fallow field, where only a few days before had stood a familiar landmark. Here, up until only a few years ago, Mrs. P. B. Ma Burks operated the last of our town's long list of boarding houses, dating back to the beginning of the university. And what was amazing was a beetle-haired, bewhiskered young man, in the usual skin-tight trousers, who was emerging from the debris of the fallen building with a length of lumber balanced on his shoulder. It was the first time I'd ever seen a beatnik toting anything heavier than a thick volume of modern poetry, or, at the most, a six-pack of king-sized beer. No wonder I nearly busted the red light at the Henderson Street crossing. It was indeed an incongruous tableau, this lugubrious byproduct of our jittery modern society rummaging around the dying memories of a once gay facet of our small-town living. The boarding house used to be as much a part of the small college town community as chapel assembly or classes, or the commons or fraternities, or any of the other school events or social gatherings. And I'm thankful for my limited, though very pleasant experience, with boarding house fare around here, though it may well be that there was more than little of the dedicated glutton in me that Lewis Graves, in one of his chaff pieces, said described himself when he was at table in his mother's boarding house, which stood where the Carolina Inn is now located. When it's sitting right in front of you, it's mighty hard to resist. In my youth, you had to walk a good way from the center of the village to get out of china-clanking distance of a boarding house, and almost or any of our other improvised games till approaching nightfall. It was, perhaps more than anything else, the kitchen noises and the agonizingly delicious aroma of cooking food emanating from a nearby boarding house that broke up the contests and set us hightailing back to our own homes to see what was in the pot. In those days, there were many boarding houses in the village, feeding townspeople, students and faculty, and administration people alike. Some of them which come to mind were Mrs. A.A. Queenie Klutz's, Mrs. Fred Patterson's, Mrs. Ledbetter's, Mrs. Merritt's, Mrs. Elliott's, Mrs. Daniels, Mrs. Humphrey's, Mrs. Wallace Patterson's, Mrs. Damon Brooks, and Ma Burke's. Besides these establishments, which were mainly for townsfolk and university people, there were other boarding houses run by students. Two of these, which I remember very well because of their proximity to our old home where the University Methodist Church now stands, were The Cabin, which was on the site of the present Porthole Restaurant parking lot, and The Coop, which was in a house located just east of the Ackland Art Gallery, and which was utilized for many years as a kindergarten by Mrs. Robert Wettich. Two noisier or happier boarding houses I fail to recollect. There were, of course, other student-run eating places from time to time. And, though it was not a private enterprise, no Chapel Hillian of the period will ever forget the biggest and most storied of all local boarding houses, the late university-operated Swain Hall, for many years under the firm and loving care of O.B. Harmon, later a Raleigh insurance executive. And now, boarding houses in the classic sense of the word are just pleasant memories to the old-timers of our town. In a way, it's a pity. Never has there been devised a more sociable or entertaining way to take on nourishment in a public place than to sit down with your friends and have the food before it's been chopped up, without worrying about finding a seat, without wondering if you've got the right check, without using body English as a cafeteria counter girl scrapes some of your helping off the plate and back into the steam table container, without someone breathing down your back while waiting for you to relinquish your seat even before you get your after-dinner cigarette lit. There are, of course, many reasons given for the demise of the boarding houses here and elsewhere as well. The high price of produce, the growing number of school-owned and public eating houses of the first caliber, the scarcity of good help, the greater variety of jobs available for women which are less exacting than handling food, and many others. But I wonder if perhaps another cause for the closing of our boarding houses isn't that more and more folks nowadays are shying away from being analyzed, especially when they're hungry. Board house eating is personal, almost as personal as family eating. It's 3 times a day contact with the same folks week after week, not like in cafes and cafeterias where you can choose your fellow diners or eat alone. And if you can't read a person's character from across a boarding house table, then you just can't read. And if you can, then so can others too. The day they uncrated magnificent Excelsior. Nowadays, motorcycles skitter through traffic, purring and or popping among and around automobiles and pedestrians in such numbers as to cause no more than an occasional annoyed or perhaps envious glance in the direction of their passing. But no matter how many bikes I see or hear, any one of them is liable to remind me of the first one I ever touched, and by all odds, the most fascinating one I've ever known. It was on a sunny afternoon back in the spring of 1920 when Luther Edwards' old solid-tired Model T truck brought Dad's crated motorcycle from Captain Smith's Carborough Limited train and put it down in the front yard of the old Barbie house, which stood where is now located the United Methodist Church. And it caused quite a commotion when Dad and my brothers and I, and the late Herbert Pendergraft, his father ran a store where Ledbetter Pickards now operates, uncrated that new bike and set it up on its back wheel stand. Never before or since have I seen such a big motorcycle. Well, that tall anyhow. There it stood in shiny battleship gray with Excelsior written across its gas tank. Dad had bought it second hand from Mother's nephew, who had shipped it up from Birmingham, Alabama. We were a proud set of young'uns when Dad finally got it running and took off down Franklin Street, real natty in his World War I khaki breeches and leather puttees. Soon Dad was getting pretty good with the bike, maybe a little too fancy for his own good. Anyway, it wasn't too long before he took his first spill. Mother was over at Watts Hospital in Durham awaiting an appendix operation, and naturally Dad had to ride the bike over to see her. In those days, the road entering the hospital was covered with crushed rock, which must have slipped Dad's mind, because when he whipped into the driveway, his bike went one way and he went another, both of them on the rocks. To make things worse, Mother was watching out of the window, as proud as punch, when, to her horror, she saw the spill. Dad wasn't hurt, but for many years it was a family joke that they had to bandage up Dad's scratched knees and legs before they could operate on Mother. But though my brothers and I were proud of Dad's having the bike and all, we still weren't getting much out of the deal. What we wanted was to ride, and it wasn't long in coming. From somewhere, Dad got hold of a sidecar, which, on looking back, seemed to be as big as a bathtub. The first ride in this sidecar was one I'll never forget. It was down in Baby Hollow. Our family had moved from the Barbie place to the new home in Park Place. And if the houses were like they are now on Hooper Lane, we'd have gone right through the Lyman Cotton's front door. Somehow or other, the sidecar hadn't been hooked up as it should have been. Dad piled Fred, Chip, and me in the tub, cranked up the bike, and started up Hooper Lane toward Battle Lane. But just as we started out, the bike began listing toward the south, and, despite all Dad could do to straighten it up, we described a beautiful and bouncing arc across the road and down through the underbrush, briars, and broom straw that grew right where the Cotton's house now stands. Well, that was quite an introduction to sidecar riding for three little wide-eyed boys, to say nothing of their hand-wringing mother. Dad, I suspect, was too busy to be frightened. But soon Dad and Fred, the mechanic of the group, had it fixed properly, and we crawled back in and took off for town, as happy a trio of youngsters as you'd want to see anywhere. Dad took us for many rides after that, though I don't remember Mother ever getting into the contraption. Two of us would sit on the sidecar seat, while the other would squat on a wooden box placed on the floor and would peer out over the prow, wind-blown tears streaming down his cheeks. Where that bike finally went to, I couldn't tell you now if my life depended on it. But I do remember that we young'uns were saddened greatly by its departure, at least until we got that brand-new 1923 Dodge touring car. As for Mother, I recall that she seemed very happy at Excelsior's exit, and I can't say that I blame her. Because, from subsequent experiences with motorbikes, some of them harrowing, I've concluded that the only thing that takes more guts than riding a motorcycle is to watch a loved one take off on one of them, even without a sidecar of young'uns attached. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.